The great model that Canifani deployed in the 70s was to say, oh, look, the Kassam revolt in the 30s understood a triple opposition to the settler colonial, to the imperial, and to the class violence, which together reproduced the dispossession of Palestinians. And the ingenious move that Canifani makes was to say in the 1970s, the configuration of those three things is not today identical. That is to say, the Zionists were no longer lobbyists for a state, but had become a state. The imperial enemy was no longer centrally Britain, though Britain remains important, but America. And the class forces were no longer simply local bourgeoisies, but rather Arab states ruled by reactionary and bourgeois, petty bourgeois forces. So he was able to take that tripartite model and renew it for new times. And that, I think, is the challenge for revolutionaries today.
This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of our live event series. Haymarket Books is a radical, independent publisher dedicated to connecting social movements with the ideas they need in the struggle for a better world. You can help support the Haymarket Project by buying books at haymarketbooks.org and especially by joining the Haymarket Book Club. By joining the book club, you get all new Haymarket titles delivered to your door and a 50% discount on the entire Haymarket website, all for one low price. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast and the Haymarket YouTube channel to access all of our upcoming events. If you really want to help us out, rate and review the podcast on Apple or whatever platform you're listening on.
Israel unleashed its brutal onslaught on Gaza that has so far killed over 11,200 people, amongst them 4,600 children, almost 200 healthcare workers, dozens of journalists, wounded over 26,000, destroyed dozens of thousands of buildings, targeted over 100 health facilities and hospitals, churches, mosques, schools, and displaced over 1.5 million people. As we know and fear, the destruction is likely to be even worse than this. And yet, amidst all of this catastrophe and genocide, global leaders have either remained silent or worse, refused to call for a ceasefire, and in the case of Western powers, directly armed Israel to continue committing its war crimes against the Palestinian people. US and UK ships were even deployed to the Eastern Mediterranean and European troops to Cyprus to support Israel. The levels of complicity are considerable. This only reinforces the need for international solidarity and action. Palestinians have been fighting for over 75 years for their liberation. We cannot just stand by amidst the merciless slaughter. Over the course of the last few weeks, millions have mobilized across every corner of the world. In some countries, national protests have been weekly. In London, 1 million people marched in solidarity just this past weekend, and Washington saw its largest Palestine demonstration in US history. Local actions taking across Europe, from rallies applying pressure on politicians to the targeting of arms factories and the refusal of unionized workers to handle Israeli weapons, have also shown the potential for mass mobilizations against injustice. Contrary to many leaders in the Middle East and North Africa, people across the region, including in Jordan, Egypt, Kuwait, Iraq, Morocco, and Algeria, have also taken to the streets en masse, calling for an end to Israel's killing, regional normalization, and the occupation. This is because many understand that the Palestinian cause is one for every revolutionary, as Ghassan Canifani put it. Just as the continued colonization of Palestine is important for rulers, it's also the case for progressive movements everywhere. I'd like to now introduce our brilliant speakers, who will, I'm sure, give us a much deeper understanding of the situation and hopefully provide us with the practical ideas about how to further our commitment to the struggle for a free Palestine. So, firstly, Barnaby Rain. He is writing his PhD at Columbia on visions of ending capitalism. He has written and spoken extensively on Zionism and Jewish radical traditions opposed to it. Many of us have been watching his brilliant interviews recently. And I say brilliant, I don't, though he thinks that I'm being sarcastic in saying that. We've all seen his followers and fans cheering him on. Secondly, we have Nihal Al-Asr, who is an Egyptian independent researcher and writer. She's written and conducted research in the Middle East and North Africa. She's a member of the Palestine Youth Movement and one of my absolute favorite people to follow on Twitter. So, my first question, Palestine has historically held a central place in revolutionary politics globally and in the region, and this is often presented by Zionist pundits as something suspicious, you know, the idea that many could oppose Israel's actions. But what role does it play for international progressive movements, including those that perhaps you're both a part of? Start with Nihal.
Hi, really glad to be here, and thanks for the lovely introduction, Malia. So in order to answer this question, we need to contextualize Palestine as an anti-imperialist and an internationalist struggle. And to do so, bear with me, I'll do like a brief historical analysis of why that is. So when it comes to discussing Palestine, you can either adopt a materialist or an idealist analysis. The idealist analysis is primarily why, if it's adopted, is primarily why people think of, you know, Palestine being an international struggle as something to be skeptical of, because it's the one we see used by Western media and liberal observers. It's the one that is pushed by the Zionist state, which is that it's an age-old complex conflict, the primary motivator of which is religion, and that the way to overcome this is dialogue and to get both sides in the room, etc., etc. But the other way to view the Palestinian struggle, which, you know, as socialists and as people on the left should do, is through a materialist lens, which means employing a different set of tools, which involves understanding the history of the Zionist state through an understanding of settler colonialism and Zionism. And within that, different methods of control and economic, political, and social domination, including apartheid. The arguments, the argument of that is that if we understand this as a project of settler colonialism, then we understand that this is a project of replacing the indigenous community with a new community. That means adopting a population-centric approach which punishes the native population for anything else other than existing and refusing to submit. So the answer to that is not, you know, simply just dialogue, or, you know, why aren't, you know, the Palestinians just, you know, refusing to stay put? Why are they resisting? Because the only way to get over this particular system of subjugation is through a project of national liberation. So yeah, through this understanding, and if we understand that this is a settler colonial project that was propped up by, Britain first through the Balfour Declaration, after a British mandate of Palestine in the early 20th century, which began to facilitate for Zionist settlers to move, and then later on as a colony that is propped up, supported, and, supported and wouldn't exist without the full support of America, then through that we can understand this as an imperialist outpost that, through that we can understand this as an anti-imperialist struggle that should have us all as anti-imperialists, as socialists, and as people on the left, that this is a cause for everyone to support.
Well, hello, everyone. It is great to be here. Thank you so much for that, Nihal. And it's a great honor to be here on this platform because Nihal has been doing such brilliant work as an organizer with the Palestinian Youth Movement and in writing and thinking, and everyone should read her essay recently on Egypt and the particular interests of the Sisi regime in relation to Palestine, which was analysis that we really needed. And it's a great pleasure always to be in anything with Malia, who I've known for, I don't know, 10 years or more, and is a really, really amazing and wonderful person and organizer. So it's wonderful to be here. And thank you to Haymarket and the New Arab and all the other organizers. And thank you to Brechner, who's an amazing organizer, for putting this on. I know those are longer thank yous than usual, but it's just a very lovely space to be in. So I'm very happy. So, the question, why people care about Palestine? Because Malia is completely right that people caring about Palestine are cast under suspicion. That we're told that there's something a little dodgy about caring about Palestine. And as ever, that something is never left vague. Something a little dodgy, we know what it means. It's the claim that people care about Palestine because they just don't like Jews and they don't like the oppression of Palestinians, not because they object to the oppression of Palestinians, but because they object to Jews doing that oppressing. I should say there are probably some people like that. I mean, I think there are some people in the right wing of Western countries who think that, you know, it should be up to Western governments to oppress Arabs and not Jews. I'm sure that exists as a kind of reactionary current. But on the global left, those of us who care about freedom, it's no mystery why we care about Palestine. We want everyone everywhere to be free. And the crucial thing to grasp is this is a kind of double mistake. It's not really true that millions of people who pour into the streets all over the world to show their solidarity with Palestinians are doing so because they care much about the religion of the colonizer. It's not really true that they're doing so because they're obsessed with Jews and hate Jews. They're doing so because they care about and oppose colonialism, and they oppose colonial violence, subjugation, domination, apartheid, dispossession, all of the list of things, the list of crimes in international law and beyond the frame of international law, that we can pin to Israel's door. So just as it isn't true that people pour into the streets because they care about Israel's Jewishness, just as they care about Israel's, in the vast majority, about Israel's colonial character, well, it also isn't true that the states around the world that support Israel care much about its Jewishness, though they may sometimes use that for rhetorical effect. They also support it. Why does America and Britain and France support the state of Israel? Because they support colonialism, not because they care much about Jews. So in both cases, both Israel's supporters and opponents, there's this convenient rhetorical garb, which matters a great deal to lots of Zionists, it's true. But to their global supporters and opponents, it's not the crucial thing. So why then do people care so much about Palestine? Well, the first thing to acknowledge here is that it wasn't always the case. And so the first thing that Zionists are rightly noticing and are opposed to and shocked by and uncomfortable about is the turn in the West, in the global North, especially in the years after 1967, the gradual turn towards an understanding of Israel as a violent dominating power, not as a plucky victim that should be supported. The state of Israel only exists today because the Soviet Union voted to support its birth in 1948. And if you look around the world at the publications of communist parties in the late 1940s and very early 1950s, you see a huge amount of support for the state of Israel. And beyond communist parties, left movements in what you might, to be honest, call the largely white world, were broadly sympathetic with Israel. Partly that's about a processing of Holocaust guilt and the failure of Western ruling classes, and indeed most people in the West, to prevent the culmination of two millennia of Christian European anti-Semitism. And partly it's about, going along with that Holocaust guilt and enabling support for Zionism as well, the effective invisibilizing of Palestinians. So Palestinians who were defined simply as Arabs, which is a broad term that is important because it connects Palestinians to a broader political community, but it also functioned to suggest that they could just live as in Jordan as refugees, where 70% of the population is indeed Palestinian. So the invisibilizing of the specificity of Palestinian experience and identity functioned to say there wasn't really a people who were ever ethnically cleansed here, and when they were talked about, they were sometimes talked about in derogatory terms through feudal Arab leaders and so on. So there's a growing awareness from the 1960s of colonialism as a global problem, I think enabled in part in the West, in the global North, in the white world, by the entry of migrants from all over the world into post-war European societies, who brought with them political traditions of anti-colonial struggle and of anti-racist struggle, and brought to the left an awareness of the facts of colonial violence as forms of domination that the left should be aware of. So there has been a kind of improvement, which is then understood in Zionist terms as a terrifying decline, which has been an improvement in awareness of of Palestine. And with that growing awareness of colonialism has come, I think, slightly later, really only in the 80s and 90s, in the aftermath of the defeat of the apartheid fascist regime in South Africa, and awareness also of the specificity of settler colonialism, which of course is a process that explains the current makeup of the United States and Canada and Australasia, and the historic forms of state that ruled in Algeria and Vietnam and so on. So there is, from the 1950s and 60s, with the arrival of migrant populations bringing with them all kinds of radical political traditions into the West, and increasing awareness of facts of colonialism, which had been present in Western socialist debates as things that some people were opposed to. The Bolsheviks centrally organized their socialist horizon around the importance of anti-colonialism. But lots of social democratic forces, and indeed later communist forces, were kind of blasé about facts of imperial and colonial violence in the global North. There was always a struggle within Western socialism. And I think the arrival of migrants from, in Britain, from the Caribbean, from South Asia, in France, from North Africa, in Germany, from Turkey. You'll note in the populations that I describe, I'm trying to undermine the claim that this is simply a Muslim issue, that there is a huge amount of solidarity from Muslims around the world. Palestine has always been a multi-religious community in which much of the leadership of its revolution has been Christian as well as Muslim. So it's not simply a question of Muslim solidarity. That's been extremely important, and we should celebrate it, and we should resist Islamophobic attacks on Muslim participation in our political, including people with politics inspired by their Islam. But it hasn't been only a Muslim issue. It's been an issue of anti-colonial populations, I think, entering the Western left and significantly improving its awareness of the language of colonial violence. And for me, that's important because Jews were once also that population which spurred the left in the countries they live to have a greater awareness of problems of racialization. So I think that increasing awareness of colonialism, carrying on what I think was a Jewish tradition that founded communist parties all over Europe through migrant populations saying we should be concerned about questions of racial domination if we're opposed to capitalism, has then been also spurred in the aftermath of the defeat, or some might say the half defeat, of fascism in South Africa, by an increasing awareness of the specificities of settler colonialism, which allow people to understand the distinctness of the Zionist state, which of course isn't a colonial state in the form of having a metropole like British rule in India, but something a bit different. Last thing I'll say very quickly about this, because I'm going on too long and Malia will shut me up in a second, is that I think that one thing people should be aware of and we should talk about more when we think about causes for every revolutionary, is the affects, as scholars like to say now, or the feelings, the moods involved in different kinds of politics. I think this a lot. You know, I'm speaking to you from London, and I think this a lot when if you see politics in Ireland, in the north of Ireland, which remains under British rule, you see murals of both sides, big wall paintings of the pro-British side and the anti-colonial side, the so-called loyalist or unionist side and the nationalist or republican side. And what's so interesting is that they don't simply declare their support for different countries. It's not just different flags. The whole mood at work in the two kinds of images is very different. The pro-British side is all about order, tradition, hierarchy, exclusion, reaction. And the republican side, which finds its admiration for causes from Cuba to South Africa, to Kurds, to absolutely centrally Palestinians, speaks a language not simply of we happen to prefer Irish unity to British rule, but in that we happen to prefer freedom to domination. And so the whole mood and the spirit and the language is one of human beings breathing free, whereas the whole mood and the language of the Northern Irish unionist and loyalist, hardline loyalist propaganda is about control, domination, paranoia, anxiety. And I think you see absolutely that same binary in the politics of Zionism and anti-Zionism, which tags on so well to that Irish question. The loyalist community is very pro-Israeli and puts Israeli flags in their streets and so on. So one of the reasons that Palestine is a cause for every revolutionary is because where the Israeli state speaks a language of paranoia and anxiety, a language of paranoia which functions for them to legitimate facts of continuing domination of others, the Palestinian revolution has always spoken a language of human freedom, of weak people, as Ghassan Kenefani once said, weak people standing up to stronger people and demanding the right to be free. Not the right, as Zionists imagine in their constant endless projection, to ethnically cleanse anyone else, that's what colonial power does, but the right of everyone to be free.
Yeah, thank you for that, Barnaby. And just to add to that, you invoked Kenefani, and you spoke rightly that this is not a Muslim issue, that the Palestinian struggle is not a Muslim issue. So Ghassan Kenefani, the author of the quote that we're using as a title for this event, was interested in defining Palestine and the Palestinian question outside of its relation to Israel, not merely in this relational dynamic that we see. In fact, he was more concerned with the Palestinian revolution in relation to the surrounding regional dynamic and Arab states. So, for example, one of his best texts, in my opinion, is the Arab revolutions in Palestine from 1936 to 1939, which has just been recently translated, so I recommend everyone read it. It really talks about this period between 1917 and 1948, when Palestinians were organizing and resisting British colonization and Zionist settler colonialism, but specifically in this period, in the revolt of 1936 to 1939. So he was really primarily concerned with the role of Arab reactionary regimes and their alliance and the alliance between Zionism and imperialism. So it's really outside of this narrow frame of, how to define Palestine vis-a-vis Israel, or it's outside of this even narrow framing of the two-state versus the one-state solution. He analyzed this not only as a Palestinian-Israeli question, but as part of the tide of Arab revolution vis-a-vis Arab reactionary regimes. And it goes beyond the one state, goes beyond its relation to Israel. And it's this recognition that the confines within which we think about Palestine are extremely narrow, that we need to expand our definitions and our horizons and not think of this as, it's not religious, it's not culturalist, no biological markers, national this, ethnic that. It's about the politics you choose, the choices you make. It's a universal struggle of sharedness that speaks the language of, humanism, not cultural particularism. And through that lens, we can see the Palestinian struggle as part of a third world movement to achieve liberation in the name of socialism, not in the name of culture and religion.
And on that note, and perhaps this clarifies why it is beyond those confines, is understanding why Israel is so important to ruling classes in the West and the Arab region. Maybe if Nihal, if we consider Palestinian Marxist George Habesh's explanation that the road to Jerusalem passes through Amman, Damascus, and Cairo. How is that relevant today, and why is it of such interest to effectively maintain the status quo?
Yeah, thanks for that, Mali. That's a really good question. So one of the main things that has been asked since October 7th is, where are the Arab states? Why are they not doing anything? Why are they not helping Palestinians? And that is not, like, it shouldn't be a surprise to anyone that the Arab states are not helping Palestine or Palestinians, because it is by design that, the heads of most Arab states are, and the Arab regimes are reactionary regimes, are, counter-revolutionary regimes. And they are so because their populations are largely anti-Zionist, largely pro-Palestine. We've seen, thousands of people, hundreds of thousands of people march in Yemen, in Lebanon, in Iraq. We were galvanized by images of, people in Tahrir Square for the first time since 2013, embassies stuck by Molotovs in Bahrain and Jordan, etc., and so on and so forth. But, unfortunately, one of the main reasons that, Arab states are not allowed to democratize is because their populations, our populations, are largely pro-Palestine, are largely anti-Zionist, and will not stand for what's happening. So it is by design that we have regimes and governments that are propped up by the U.S., propped up by empire to basically be client states and to have normalized relations with Israel, and we've seen that happen through firstly through Sadat in the Camp David Accords, but then more recently in the Abraham Accords, which have, for all purposes, proven to be complete failures. But to go back to kind of like the start of that, I'm going to speak about Egypt because I'm from Egypt, but the Egyptian national identity was forged with Palestine. When Nasser took power in the 50s, one of the main reasons he took power because of his staunch opposition of the bloody creation of the Israeli state in 1948, and the Egyptian national identity that came with Nasser was forged in opposition to the Zionist state and to Israel. And we've seen, you know, we've seen stark examples of that. For example, in 1956, when Nasser nationalized the Suez Canal, we saw the tripartite aggression that included not only Israel, but France and Britain to stop that and to stop, you know, to stop basically Egypt from going through this process of socialization that we'll see emerged out of its position in, you know, global capitalism that was forced on it during the Cold War era. And we've seen, you know, there was a brief moment of the Arab world, like with Nasser at his helm's project of pan-Arabism, which included Arab socialism as a large part of it, almost still towards socialism. We saw that in Yemen, in Iraq, in Oman. But obviously, things didn't go that way through, you know, internal failures and external failures. And then after the Cold War and with, you know, Sadat at the helm, with Sadat coming as the president, as the predecessor, as a successor of Nasser, we saw him, and that coincided obviously with the fall of the Soviet Union, we saw him go towards, you know, capitalism, open up the economy, have agreements with the IMF, strengthen relations with the US, and immediately, you know, do normalize with Israel in the Camp David Accords. And then after that, we saw Egypt, as well as, you know, other Arab states become more and more dependent on, you know, the US via trade agreements, via loans from the IMF that saw them lose sovereignty, basically becoming, you know, and becoming less self-sufficient, and which eroded their sovereignty massively, making them unable to stand against the US and Israel today.
Wow, that was great. And what to add? I mean, the place that I tend to start here, not historically, but analytically, is 1956, when Britain and France wanted to, or felt that they needed to, send a military expedition to the Suez Canal in Egypt in order to secure access to a trade route, which, if it was deprived to them, they would have to transport commodities from India to Europe by going all the way around Africa. So the Suez Canal is an absolutely crucial trade route. And as part of the anti-colonial tide, in which the early neoliberals fretted with Carl Schmitt, the great fascist philosopher, that anti-colonial governments would make the error, the analytical error, as far as they were concerned, of confusing sovereignty as a political fact with sovereignty as a social, material, economic fact. That is to say, anti-colonial peoples would seek not only to elect a government to fly their own flag from the government headquarters in their capital city, they would then want that government to have control over their resources. Because part of the central, and here we have a cause for every revolutionary, that those words echoing for us again, central to the anti-colonial impetus all over the world, was the idea that people had their labor exploited, their resources deprived of them, their land taken from them by distant powers. And so the anti-colonial impulse was not just a demand that people should elect governments of their own that would then be powerless, toothless in the face of global capital, in the face of continuing Western economic power. The anti-colonial impulse was a demand that people should be able to control their own resources so that they should be able to construct for themselves dignified lives. And that demand took so many different forms. It took the great form of the new international economic order, where countries around the world tried to propose to the UN General Assembly the transformation of the world economic order. And that was then undone in a great counter-revolution that we now call neoliberalism, whose international dynamics are still too rarely acknowledged. It also took the form 10, 15 years earlier than the NIEO of Gamal Abdel Nasser in Egypt saying, not a revolutionary communist by any means, but a kind of anti-colonial nationalist for whom it was obvious that Egyptians should have control of their own canal. And so that proposition that Egyptians should have control of their own canal was terrifying to a global imperial order, which had allowed some form of national notional political independence, but didn't want the trade in commodities, which was controlled from London and Paris, to have to answer to anyone in Cairo. That disrupting of the colonial order was far more severe than the kind of disruption represented by the flying of the Egyptian flag over the government headquarters in Cairo. That was a real material disruption. And so Britain and France had to intervene. I say had to, not on any principle of sort of natural right, but on the logic of colonial power to which they were wedded, had to intervene in order to defend the continued colonial control of resources by defending colonial control of the Suez Canal when Nasser wanted to nationalize it. It was much easier for them to try to intervene. Happily, the intervention didn't go very well, but it was much easier for them to try to intervene because they had a new kid on the block. They had a new friend in the region. This is 1956, 8 years ago. The state of Israel has been born in Palestine, the Zionist state. It's very important that we say the Zionist state in Palestine, by the way, because one of the many forms of violence the Zionist state does is claims this name Israel, which is the name of my people. Shema Yisrael, our great prayer. Hear, O Israel, says God to us. I am the Lord your God. And when they claim that name, just like when they claim all of its symbols, the Star of David and so on, they tell the whole world that they represent Jews. And then, of course, they get upset when people take that literally. It's the Zionist state in Palestine, which calls itself Israel. I know that's a bit of a mouthful. The Zionist state was there in the region and was able to provide support, not just in the region, but right next door, support for Britain and France to engage in the defense of colonial power. So here you have a logic. Here you have a dynamic. The state of Israel, a policeman perched in the region, a fortress in the colonial wilderness. This is how colonial power sees most of the world. And that fortress in the wilderness, imagine, just like if you're an imperialist anywhere and you see this big desert in front of you far away, you want to build some fortresses in that desert to defend your access to resources in that desert. And if there's lots of oil in the desert, it's very important that you've got some fortresses there to defend it. That's the function that South Africa served in sub-Saharan Africa. That's the function the apartheid regime served. It's the function the Zionist regime served in 1956. And it's enduringly been the function. And that's why Joe Biden stood on the floor of the US Senate and said, if Israel didn't exist, we'd have to invent it. And it's very important to stress that because that relationship can be disordered and confused. People can think when they see powerful governments around the world doing everything to support the Israeli state while it massacres children, that the Israeli state must have committed some kind of cunning conspiracy to control the interests of powerful governments around the world. People can think that America is in the control of the state of Israel. And sections of the American right are anti-Israel and say, why do we spend so much money supporting Israel? It must be that there's a Jewish conspiracy that controls America, they say. In fact, of course, the reassuring aspect of that conservative form of politics is that it imagines that American power is basically benign and has just been misdirected by a small conspiracy of outsiders, or British or French power are basically benign and have just been misdirected. And all that's needed is to elect nicer governments that will tell these Israeli lobbyists to go away. Of course, Israel has a very powerful global lobby, which is very important in ensuring support for its state. But the problem runs deeper. And for us, and if we're talking about causes for every revolutionary, we're revolutionaries because we think that Western imperial power is itself a violent, dangerous phenomenon. And so we have the reverse understanding. It's not that some Israel lobbyists have captured Western power, though the Israel lobby is powerful and important and does all kinds of dangerous things, but rather that Western imperial power finds a use for a colonial fortress in the region. And that's been the case clearly in 1956, clearly today. It's been the case when the West wants to relate antagonistically to Iran, for example, when they launched their war against Iraq. In all of these occasions, the firm support of the state of Israel has been absolutely crucial to broader Western imperial interests. And that's why, to finish with the point that Nihal started with, that's why when Ghassan Kanafani, and I think it was 1972, wrote that piece about the Arab revolts of 1936 to 39, the crucial intervention he was making was to say, our opposition as Palestinians, Kanafani said, is not just to Zionist settler colonists. The thing that the revolt in the 1930s recognized was that in order to successfully oppose Zionist settler colonization, which was going to push Palestinians out of their land as it did in the catastrophe of 1948, it was necessary to understand the links between Zionist settler colonization and British imperialism, which found Zionism useful and so promised them the land in 1917 in the Balfour Declaration. And in order to understand how that link between imperialism and settler colonialism was manufactured and reproduced, it was necessary to understand the class forces locally, which could benefit the Palestinian bourgeoisie from enabling the dispossession of other Palestinians as long as they stood to gain a piece of the pie. Well, today in cities like Rawabi in the West Bank, you see continued attempts by sections of the Palestinian elite to partner with the Israelis. Indeed, one could think of the whole Palestinian Authority regime in the West Bank through this kind of frame, continued attempts by sections of Palestinian society on a class basis to profit by their connections to settler colonialism. So the great model that Kanafani deployed in the 70s was to say, oh, look, the Qassam revolt in the 30s understood a triple opposition to the settler colonial, to the imperial, and to the class violence, which together reproduced the dispossession of Palestinians. And the ingenious move that Kanafani makes was to say in the 1970s, the configuration of those three things is not today identical. That is to say, the Zionists were no longer lobbyists for a state, but had become a state. The imperial enemy was no longer centrally Britain, though Britain remains important, but America. And the class forces were no longer simply local bourgeoisies, but rather Arab states ruled by reactionary and bourgeois, petty bourgeois forces. So he was able to take that tripartite model and renew it for new times. And that, I think, is the challenge for revolutionaries today.
Yeah, exactly like you said, Barnaby, it's not, the relation between Israel and the West is a material relation. It's, and an internationalist framework is the only framework to resist this. And it's not only that, but we've seen from, recent Israeli statements and, you know, a look at the Zionist state's past, that this is, it's not just the status quo. It is an expansionist project. We've seen, Israeli state officials saying, Lebanon is ours, like Jordan, the Sinai. And we've seen this before in history, the Golan Heights is occupied Syrian land. The Zionist state also occupied the south of Lebanon. It occupied Sinai. We've seen the war drums that are being beat against Iran. The Zionist state is pushing, America to beat the war drums against Iran. And so we have to recognize Zionism as a reactionary force in the world that we need to oppose.
Thank you both for that. What does this struggle mean for, in terms of the activities of revolutionaries today?
You keep going first and doing so well, Nihal. Does this mean it's my turn, or does this mean I can make you do it again?
I just finished speaking. You should go first this time for a change.
Damn. Yeah, okay. Okay, I get to listen to Nihal, see what she's saying, and then riff on that, and it's much easier. Now she's making me do the hard thing. So the hardest question is always the question that 19th century novelist and then an early 20th century revolutionary asked, which is what is to be done? We can feel powerless because we face, especially in a country like Britain or a country like the United States, we face a state apparatus which is utterly in lockstep with the Israeli state, and which will sometimes issue small measured criticisms in order to restrain popular discontent, but is totally behind the Israeli state, both for reasons of material recognition and kind of ideational recognition. That is to say, they understand that their interests are to ensure that they have a continued colonial policeman in the region, and also the American settler colonists recognize Israeli settler colonists as someone like them. The British imperialist racist state recognizes the Israeli imperialist racist state as something like them. Indeed, the guides that are sometimes produced by Hasbara organizations say, emphasize when you're an Israeli that you're like your Western audiences and unlike these savage, backward Palestinians. And so the state apparatuses that we live under are thoroughly behind Israel. And I use state apparatus in a very broad sense, including the parties of official opposition and so on, tend usually to be very behind the Zionist state. And so we can feel powerless. But the glorious thing is to recognize that one of the reasons that they get nervous is that there are large sections of the population, even in the global north, enormous sections of the population around the world, the vast majority of the population of the world, and we shouldn't forget that, and large sections of the population, even in what used to be called the imperial core, which are horrified by the scale of Israeli violence. And the coalitions to be built around Palestine are very, very beautiful ones. Because what the colors of the Palestinian flag represent is a refusal to surrender even in conditions of great difficulty, and the refusal to give up a horizon of victory and freedom, which says I should be able to live in my own home, tend to my olives, or study at a university round the corner from my house, be treated in a hospital when I'm sick and not have hospitals bombed while people flee to them because they've themselves been bombed. It is a horizon of a life lived in freedom and under conditions of dignity. And that hope that people who are systematically maligned, dehumanized, with whom we're allowed to sympathize only when they're bombed because they should get a kind of bare life, that hope that instead people should be able to live a life of dignity, that admiration for the refusal to surrender of people who are told that they are just terrorists and should just accept a life that their colonizer judges acceptable for them in a system of fragmented Bantustans called a two-state solution. That refusal to surrender, the insistence on struggling onwards until victory, is a thing that inspires many, many thousands of people who get on small boats to try to cross the Mediterranean to reach a safer life, knowing that they face the possibility of death unaided by European power, which would rather see them die than live a life of safety. That possibility of freedom inspires people who work night shifts in Amazon warehouses trying to move goods and knowing that they're only as good as their last run and they could be sacked at any minute and then won't be able to pay their bills and heat their homes and will shiver in their homes in winter. That Palestinian possibility, the colors of the flag, the black, the white, the red, and the green together represent to people a hope not only that one day the bombed of Gaza should cease to be bombed, but that one day they should be able to relax on that beautiful Mediterranean beach in conditions of freedom. And so it is a continuing mobilizing force that connects many people who are descended from the colonized all over the world with many people who are workers and who are renters and who are who face conditions of precarity and toughness, who want a life of dignity. And so with that confidence that we can mobilize large numbers of people on the boldest and noblest idea known to mankind, which is the idea of human freedom, we should protest, come out into the streets, lobby our politicians when they support the state of Israel. With confidence, we should do these things. We should boycott Israeli products and use the official guidance put out by the Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions Movement to see what you should be boycotting. We should be pressuring the organizations for which we work and to which we're affiliated, whether that's churches or, you know, I'd like to say someday synagogues, to divest from the Israeli state. Dutch pension funds, when they divested from the Israeli state, made a meaningful dent. You know, we can do really good work there. And ultimately, we want to be lobbying for that third part of the BDS movement, which is too rarely mentioned, which is for sanctions on the Israeli state. And that was a really important part of the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa. We should be pushing to limit the violence supplies to the Israeli state that allow it to carry out its acts of violence. And from the port of Genova in Italy to California, workers have done heroic work in refusing to handle arms that were going to be sent to the state of Israel to do damage. In Britain, we've had now a series of blockades of arms factories at BAE Systems and Elbit. And this week we have the trial of eight people who heroically disrupted the arms production of Elbit Arms Systems, one of the world's biggest suppliers of arms to the state of Israel. They're on trial in London this week, and people should go down to support them for their heroic acts. We should also be ensuring that we have networks of solidarity for those who face the repressive backlash, especially in Western countries, for solidarity with Palestine. People should support the European Legal Support Center in Europe, Palestine Legal in the United States, should give them money and support. And if people are lawyers or know lawyers, they should be encouraging lawyers to help out with that support when people need it. People should also be in unions that can support them when they face those repressive backlashes. So there's actually lots of things that we can be doing, which we should do with confidence that we represent the global majority who believe not in the domination of all of us by a tiny handful to continue to make profits, a domination which is enabled by racialized hierarchies that say that some people's lives just aren't worth living and that some children should just deserve to die. We represent the global majority, which says instead that people should live in freedom.
Yeah, exactly. I agree with everything Barnaby said. And, you know, to also quote Lenin, yeah, there are decades where nothing happens and weeks where decades happen. And we've seen, we're experiencing decades of shifts in the consciousness of millions of people. While we saw millions galvanized in the global south, we've also seen a mass movement rising in the global north to confront Zionism, unlike we've seen in our lifetimes. Like everyone can attest that this is what we've been seeing in London are the largest pro-Palestine demos we've seen. We saw the largest pro-Palestine demo in the US in the belly of the beast. And I think that's because people are being forced to confront that the systems they work for is genocidal and that is in opposition to their principles. We're seeing, you know, a sharpening of the contradictions where the liberal international order is laid bare for everyone to see, and people can tell they're being lied to. And this Palestine is the Palestinian cause, and the Palestinian question is the place, the epitome of that. So we must continue to sharpen these contradictions and to see the reality of the systems we live under, with the goal of building power rather than liberal demand making, and to be the subjects and authors of history, to be the protagonists. And the way we can do that is that the battle of for Palestine is a battle within our locales. The laws that are being used against us now to crack down on, like you've mentioned, crackdowns on protests and censorship, these are the same laws that were made specifically in response to the vibrant social and anti-racist movements in England in the 60s and 70s to dismantle them, and that were sharpened in previous years against the climate movement. We must also anticipate a response to the Palestine demos and the infrastructure that we're seeing that is being built around this moment. It's a fight against the repressive governments that we live under in the global north and in the global south. When people are saying, you know, Palestine is freeing us too, which I know is a bit like, you know, a bit sappy or whatever, but I do believe that's true. Everyone has been given a chance to, you know, show up for, not only show up for Palestine, but dismantle the state structures that use the same tools to suppress actions for Palestine against any other, you know, quest or request, ask for our basic rights and freedoms.
Absolutely. And do you see the potential for connecting some of those actions, as small as and as local as they may seem, to wider international ones, particularly in terms of refining our tools and our abilities to resist, to apply them to kind of multiple, to different movements and contexts and so on? Barnaby, do you want to start?
Absolutely. I mean, why is Palestine a cause for every revolutionary? Let's just give a short answer right now. In 1920, I've been tempted because Nihal mentioned Lenin. In 1920, the Bolsheviks assembled a conference, a Congress of the Peoples of the East at Baku, and they issued a series of extraordinary statements, huge numbers of people flooding in from all over Asia, lots of interpreters, different languages. And they issued a final statement, and it was called An Appeal to the Workers of Europe. And it makes for striking reading when we know what happened next in the development of 20th century European history, because it says to the workers of Europe, you may be tempted to have a form of politics which says that you can guarantee for yourselves healthcare, education, decent wages by tapping into some of the profits of an imperial world order, which are currently flowing only really to the bosses of Europe, and which you could try to redirect to the workers of Europe too. That may be a tempting form of politics, say the thousands of people assembled from all over Asia at the Baku Congress inspired by the Russian Revolution. But don't be silly, they say, don't be fooled, because if you do not take on the power of that imperial system, those people who now are brutalizing us will brutalize you too. That is the message that people from all over the world choose to send to socialist politics in the imperial core, the West, the global North, the white world order, whatever you want to call it, in those places which have historically been the organizing centers of global appropriation and violence from the transatlantic slave trade to the colonization of India and beyond. The message is not be ashamed of yourselves, feel guilty for your for the benefits you have taken from empire. That's not the language of politics that mobilizes and inspires. It is come on board with us and recognize that together we can take apart a system of global domination and all be free, or we will all burn and die together. In a world of climate catastrophe, this point is even more accentuated. If you do not take on the systems of power, if you try to do a deal with them for your own benefit, we will all suffer. And that is particularly relevant And so we see in Palestine today forms of brutal, violent power, which, as Gustavo Petro, the president of Colombia, said, tell all of us the kind of future which awaits us in an epoch of climate brutality, to be rendered inhuman, to be rendered dehumanized, to be rendered subhuman, to be rendered human animals, human beasts. The language the Israeli state uses about Palestinians will be used for many millions as the walls get higher to keep out climate refugees. That is especially relevant to those of us who today grapple, as well we all do, with the passing of an era of unilateral American hegemony and the coming of an era of increasing multipolarity, in which we face the question in the global north, will we be engaged as the left in the defense of that Western imperial order? They like to use euphemisms for it, like the liberal order or the rules-based order. It's hard to see what rules are at stake when Iraq violates apparently 2 UN resolutions and gets munitions dropped on Fallujah, which ensure that babies still today are born with defects, while Israel violates dozens of UN resolutions and receives support from the West. So these euphemisms are almost comical: humanitarian intervention rather than imperial violence, and so on. So do we become invested in the defense of that Western order because it has granted us in the West some privileges? Or do we join with people everywhere seeking to bring down that order, not in the name of replacing one imperial hegemon with another, but in the name of a kind of universal human freedom? That is the hope which we take from the Palestinian struggle, which tells us not to stand at the back of the room and be what is sometimes in politics today called allies, to think of ourselves as separate from the cause but supporting others, which tells us not, as so much identity politics today tells us, to consult only people who come from a particular place and do whatever they say. It infuriates me when people are arguing about anti-Semitism and they say, well, tell me what you think as a Jew. And I say, well, what do you think as a person who has thoughts? The Palestinian cause instead says, in our thousands, in our millions, we are all Palestinians. And that is not a refusal to understand the differences between us. It doesn't mean that I can just sit here glibly and tell you about Palestine and not listen when Palestinians tell me I've made a mistake. But it does mean that we recognize that there are things that we hold in common as people who believe in human freedom and who stand to gain from universal human freedom and to lose from a continuing regime of brutalization, which exists globally and in which Palestinians are at the sharp end. So that common interest, not the politics of allyship, but the politics of solidarity that recognizes that we all have something to gain from the freedom of Palestinians, that imagines that moment, just as people once saw Nelson Mandela walking free from prison, imagines that moment when all the walls are gone in the West Bank and the siege on Gaza is ended and I can go to pray at the Western Wall in Jerusalem alongside Palestinian Christians and Muslims praying in freedom. We imagine that moment as a moment that will signal not just the freedom of Palestine from the river to the sea, which it will, but all of our freedom everywhere, because it will mean the downfall of those forces that seek to dominate and divide us, that seek to tell us that some human beings have to be pitted against others on grounds of race or religion rather than the kinds of grounds of social power and class that we know actually organize domination in our world, and those forces that seek to dehumanize us. When we beat all of those forces together, we'll be able to say Palestine really was a cause for every revolutionary, and then we'll have to find new causes.
Nihal?
Yeah, thank you, Barnaby. That was beautiful. And yeah, just to, as a silver lining, I think even amidst all of this horror, people can really tell now that the Zionist state, the Zionist project, is not a sustainable project. Like, people have never before thought about this can see that this is not a project that can be sustained on the long run, and can see cracks and fissures within it. This is how we can explain the extremely, extremely violent reactions of in the West, the ridiculous anti-democratic crackdowns in Germany. There was also an announcement that Germany will start rearming in order to provide troop support to Israel. We've seen, the U.S. and Britain send warships to the Mediterranean to surround Israel. This is, on top of the arms that the UK consistently sells to Israel since 2015, $400 million worth of UK-made aircrafts, bombs, and armored vehicles and ammunition has been sent to the Zionist state from Britain. Two years ago, I can't remember, but Hackney police welcomed the police delegation from the Zionist state less than a week after the assassination of Shirin Abu Akleh. Yeah, it was last year. So Yeah, so we've seen an enhancement of that, and almost we've seen the rabid reaction of our, you know, what I call them, the dictatorship of the bourgeoisie, like of Biden, of we've seen the erosion of this idea, this veneer of a two-party state system, whether it's in Britain or the US, where we've seen, you know, Biden, you know, giving cover for genocide and completely supporting it. We've seen Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer take the same exact line, and this has all been laid bare before us. So I think this sharpening of the contradiction, of the contradictions, is going to illuminate our resistance going forward.
Thank you. It saddens me to say that we're actually coming to the end of today's event. I know it's difficult in the face of the endless horrors committed by Israel, which are aided and abetted by our governments, to feel that our actions, however small, are having an impact. Yet we don't have the luxury of demoralization. And I hope that today's discussion has helped all of us think about the crucial importance of pressuring and fighting our own leaders in the long struggle for a free Palestine, especially given the direct calls that have been made to us to break the complicity, including the Palestinian General Federation of Trade Unions, that stated the genocidal situation can only be prevented by a mass increase of global solidarity, and that's called on workers to refuse to build weapons destined for Israel, to refuse to transport weapons, to pass motions in trade unions to this effect, take action against complicit companies involved in implementing the brutal and illegal siege, and pressure governments to stop all military trade with Israel, and in the case of the US funding it. As Kanafani explained, because we must end with his wise words, that when he referred to the global reach of imperialism, he said, wherever you strike it, you damage it, and you serve the world revolution. Thank you to Haymarket Books for organizing this discussion tonight, to Breckner, Sean, Miles, and the whole team for their hard work. This event is part of a long series, a longer series, Until Liberation, organized by Haymarket, and you can watch recordings of past events on their YouTube channel. Please do check them out. Also check out the Haymarket website for important books on the subjects covered by our speakers, and you can even grab some free ebooks for more resources and information about upcoming discussions. Sign up to the newsletter also via the Haymarket website. I want to give a special thanks once again to our brilliant speakers, Nihal and Barnaby. Thank you to co-sponsors The New Arab, where you'll find me every day, and essential pieces from voices across Palestine, the region, and the diaspora. Thank you all again.
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.